We're talking about disinformation purposely spreading falsehoods and misinformation, which may be spread unknowingly. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it comes at us fast. The New York Times reported at President Trump's rally in Janesville this month, he made 131 false or inaccurate statements in 90 minutes. And they said many were entirely made up. Others were casual misstatements of simple facts, some clearly intended to mislead, unquote. What misinformation have you come across? How is it spread by the people in your life? How do you respond? We're at 800-642-1234. Howard Hardy is election integrity reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and a fellow at First Draft, which trains journalists to detect and report on disinformation. Howard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
And Kathleen Culver is here, the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to you.
Thanks so much for having us. Happy to be here.
Well, Katie, let's start with you. Tell us about the Election Integrity Project and how it came to be.
Well, we this summer were focused on Wisconsin and the spread of mis and disinformation in Wisconsin. And we really wanted to do our best to empower voters with a nonpartisan approach and to mis and disinformation. And so we got together with Howard and the Wisconsin Watch, and we focused on this kind of three-pronged effort. So one, the investigative journalism that Howard is doing, and then also creating two toolkits, one for journalists to try to stem the tide of this kind of polluted information, and then another one for citizens so that they can think about what to believe, what not to believe, and importantly, what to share and what not to share.
And that can get really complicated really fast. I mean, there's so many things that you need to think about when you are looking at your social media feed or the information that you're reading online. You know, Howard, you wrote this toolkit for us and we're bombarded with information every day. How can we possibly sort through everything?
From my perspective, the Election Integrity Project is all about giving people tools to navigate the social web on their own. I think people are frustrated about this deluge of disinformation they see on Facebook and Twitter and TikTok, and they're hungry for resources that help them make sense of it all. So the Election Integrity Project strives to help people make reality-based decisions and form opinions that have good factual standing, rather than building a worldview that's based on internet rubbish.
And one of those things, Howard, is to let news outlets earn your trust. What is that journey like to earn trust?
Well, I think earning trust is a big component of it is being visible in your community, just being a local reporter who's about town and is accessible to readers and listeners and viewers. I think that just goes a really long way to be a recognizable figure that people can get to know and get to trust over time.
But local journalism is also really drying up. So how do you look at that? Because a lot of the information out there may be coming from across the country or halfway around the world.
Yeah, that's a really big concern for us here at the Election Integrity Project. We're especially in central and northern Wisconsin, we have some news deserts where maybe that region only has one or two newspapers or doesn't have one at all. And, you know, let alone a weekly newspaper that's kind of shoring up that coverage. With the fate of local news, I think is really critically important to stemming the tide of mis and disinformation on social media.
Talking with Howard Hardy, election integrity reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Katie Culver is here, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. We're learning how to track false and misleading content, how to be better news consumers. Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Katie, there is an attitude shift, too, as you approach news information, a shift in attitude as you kind of digest the news, being skeptical and not cynical. What do you see there?
I think that's such a critical point that, you know, when something comes at us, when information comes at us, if we react emotionally, if we meet it with cynicism, if we meet it with white hot anger, that's when your alarm bells should really go off. And I think we all fall victim to this. You get infuriated by something and you hit the anger emoji and you share it. That's when all of us need to slow down. Anything that is designed to hit you emotionally should make you the most skeptical. I also want to just note something about what Howard mentioned with news deserts. These news deserts are dangerous to us as citizens. There's some research showing that when news outlets are missing in communities, polarization grows. We move apart. And that's often because we're relying on social media and in these echo chambers that just reinforce our own worldviews. So as hard as it may be in local communities, particularly rural areas in Wisconsin, we have to take that extra step to try to get a balanced information diet.
We heard from Jeff from Menominee, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Jeff says, President Trump says almost everyone is recovering from the coronavirus. Has that been fact-checked, and is it true? Howard, can you field that?
Well, it's kind of similar to the claim that Senator Ron Johnson made just last week that Wisconsin had effectively flattened the COVID curve, which... considering that we're at the height of the pandemic here in Wisconsin, and
what we think is the height of the pandemic.
Correct. The height of the pandemic to date, I should say. That is a demonstrably false claim, and it has been fact-checked repeatedly.
Another thing I want to bring up, Katie, is the misinformation swirling about mail-in voting. And even the president has had his posts flagged by Twitter and Facebook as being inaccurate. And I want to ask you about when that happens and the impact of that. When even the president is spreading false information, how can people combat that?
I have so much empathy for citizens right now, to be honest. You know, all the information that comes at you, this fire hose of information, and so much of it false. When we have figures like the President of the United States or U.S. Senator or mayor or police chief, whatever, when people in positions of leadership spread this disinformation and misinformation, who are we supposed to believe, and how are we supposed to counteract that? I do think that there are some tools like the Election Integrity Project, like local journalism, national journalism. And I think people have to try to turn to those outlets and believe what is reported rather than what someone says off the top of their head at a rally or in some kind of political statement. But that's not, you know, that puts all of the onus on us as people trying to live our lives. I think we also have to start talking a lot more about the ethical obligations of these public figures. You know, journalism ethics ain't just for journalists anymore. We should demand of our political leaders, of our celebrities, of our business leaders and communities, that they are also out there trying to reinforce the truth. Coronavirus is a perfect example of this. You know, if we are spreading misinformation, that information can be lethal.
We're looking at the spread of misinformation and disinformation with Katie Culver, who directs the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. Howard Hardy here, election integrity reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Have you shared information online only to discover that it was incorrect, not true? Did you take the post down or acknowledge it was incorrect? What happened? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Less than a week to Election Day, could disinformation ramp up even more? We're talking about how to combat the flood of falsehoods, if you will, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last month, two House members wrote to FBI Director Christopher Wray asking him to investigate the origins of disinformation flooding South Florida. There has been evidence of this happening as well in Wisconsin. What ads are you seeing crossing your path? Do you find them distorting the truth as across the line? Join in at 800-642-1234. Katie Culver directs the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison, and Howard Hardy is election integrity reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and they stay with us. So, Howard, one of the tips that you have is to mix it up, to mix up your sources of news. What do you suggest? Because that, too, can be difficult to do.
Well, I'd always just recommend going to primary sources. You know, go to the homepage of a trusted newspaper or radio station in Wisconsin, or, you know, visit the website of a national news outlet that you've followed for years and have grown to trust. I think it's important for news outlets to earn our trust, as we mentioned earlier, but also for us to be willing to place our trust in them, because propagandists would have us believe that nothing can be trusted, and they would prefer that we throw up our hands and just kind of give up on this notion of noble truth. So I think it's important for us to be you know, open-minded as we go about finding reliable sources.
Frank from Fort Atkinson called, couldn't stay with us. And Frank's aunt was sending Frank emails with bad information. And Frank started sending her back articles, fact-checking her information. And then she stopped sending those emails. Katie, especially when this involves a relative or someone close to us, what do you do to, you know, have that conversation about stopping the spread of misinformation?
I think it's really important to approach it again with empathy, that, you know, this person sending this to you isn't some sort of, you know, like maniacal person trying to spread this information. That person has been manipulated by someone who's purposely trying to pollute the information environment. So Frank's aunt she's been duped by someone. And so to respond to her politely and carefully and, you know, with an open heart, I think it's really important. You know, the minute we get into kind of that cynicism and anger, you know, the hair on fire emoji in response, that's when we break down our opportunity to deliberate. You know, I hope that he and his aunt are emailing about other things, not about that misinformation. But I think it's good for him to have responded, because once we stop talking, that's when all hope is lost.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, why should we engage at all? Is there a threat when we just stop, turn it off, and don't respond at all?
I think there is a big threat of that you say, I give up. And we have, again, research that shows us that when people feel this polluted information environment, they can get confused, they can get demoralized, and then they lose their power as citizens. And that's really what we're talking about here, is, you know, being stripped of your power in a democracy. Anything that tries to get you mentioned disinformation in South Florida is also happening quite a bit in Detroit, trying to get people not to turn out to the polls. And that's ultimately what people are wanting to do. And this doesn't just matter politically, it matters in all sorts of sectors of your life. So your health, your finances, all of that. So I think it's important to, as Howard said, you know, balance things out, change things up, seek different sources so that you do feel empowered.
Katie Culver directs the Center for Journalism Ethics. Howard Hardy is election integrity reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. We're learning about the Election Integrity Project, an effort to develop resources for news consumers, for journalists, with your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Cassie, who's joining us from Sparta. Hi, Cassie. Are you there, Cassie?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess my question, a comment and question, is kind of directed toward Katie. So I've seen, you know, very frequently people share things on social media that do and obviously end up turning out to be false. And then, you know, there was brought up before, you know, should they take that down, you know, in news terminology, retract that? I guess I'm wondering, what do you feel is, you know, the damage and the implication of sharing too early, and how difficult is it to, once it's out there, people really believe it, and retracting it, just kind of like retracting a story or having a correction, you know, really is hard to do. So I guess I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, I think there's a difference between some of us as individuals with just our small followings and these opinion leaders like politicians or corporate leaders. For us, I think it's fine to say, I put a tweet out there, it was incorrect, I apologize, and you know, next time I'll slow down. For our leaders, though, I think it's important for them to retract, of course, but also for platforms to be mindful of this reach. Kate mentioned earlier mis- and disinformation about ballots, about mail-in ballots and voting. And you have seen particularly TikTok and Twitter, and to some extent Facebook, really taking that sort of mis- and disinformation seriously. You know, I have a friend who's a political scientist who says, you know, this is an unusual, bizarre year, but it's a fairly typical election. We have people requesting more mail-in voting, but we still have the same trained electors. They have sworn duties. They will count the ballots. It's going to take a little bit longer, we expect, but it's going to be a free and fair election in the United States. So we shouldn't fall victim to that kind of mis- and disinformation. And to the extent that someone is sharing that this is somehow a fraudulent election, they do need to retract it.
Do you find that news organizations issue those retractions when they, you know, maybe inadvertently got the story wrong?
Sure. I mean, we see news organizations doing that all the time. But I have to say, it's a pretty good situation with, you know, news organizations that are trying to do this right. They generally do. The reporting works out. Now, we have some huge stories where they've gone wrong, and that's been damaging to trust. I will never argue otherwise. But overall, most community news organizations are providing information that their citizens can rely on to make decisions in their lives. They may disagree. We often interpret bias in the news, but overall, it's providing me what I need to have my family, to have my job, to be healthy, and to be able to vote.
Let's bring in Mark now in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, when we were all kids, we all heard Chicken Little say that the sky was falling. And, you know, remember that went viral in the farmyard. So everybody heard that, right? We were supposed to all learn to use common sense at that time, but I guess we've forgotten that. 2 days ago, I heard an ad on the radio that basically said that a certain candidate believed in the Green New Deal. And if you go with the Green New Deal, you're going to increase your utility bills by $40,000. Now, if that's true, I'm going to go out and buy every utility stock I can get. Right? So anyway, that was one of the more outlandish ads I've heard. And I thought immediately, how ridiculous could that be? But some people probably believe it.
Howard, what do you make of these outlandish claims that you see in the ads like Mark brought up?
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of empathy for Mark and other social media users and radio listeners and TV viewers who are coming across these really misleading and sometimes just blatantly false advertising. Quite frankly, Facebook specifically hasn't been very good at policing its own platform when it comes to political ads. We see even when an ad has been flagged as misleading or false, that textually identical ads that contain the same core message but are maybe tweaked very slightly or are presented at a different URL are allowed to continue spreading online. So It's a really big problem, and as Katie mentioned before, I think we really need to be thinking about holding our public elected officials and also these platforms to a higher standard.
Katie, as we start to wrap up, what type of misinformation are you looking for or watching for to unfold, after the general election, after Tuesday?
Yeah, well, that's the giant question, right? How long is it going to take us to know the results of the election? You know, a lot of Americans are used to knowing that on election night or the following morning. We really could have a different situation this year because of the amount of mail-in balloting and early balloting, depending on what state you're in, by the way. It varies from state to state what can be counted and when. So I'm watching for mis and disinformation like that. And also importantly, any misinformation that tries to foment civil unrest in the aftermath of this. And I think it is critically important for journalists to be reporting responsibly if we do have protests, if there is any unrest in response. I'm really hoping that we're all like Mark and we don't listen to Chicken Little and we accept the results of a free and fair election, whether our candidate prevailed or not. I really hope that that's where we're at.
Thank you both for joining us. Katie Culver directs the Center for Journalism Ethics, Howard Hardy with an election integrity reporter. We have a link, by the way, to their toolkit at WPR.org/mornings. News update is next on the Ideas Network. Ever since COVID forced us to work from home, it's posed considerable challenges to workplace communication. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ugh, those video meetings, right? Awkward silence, cue the crickets, someone's muted, someone gets booted off, they're back, they miss stuff, someone else is breaking up, we got dribs and drabs. The drama. Are you working from home? How do you communicate with your colleagues? Do you use Zoom or Google Meet, WebEx, Slack? How's it going? We're at 800-642-1234. Sarah McKinnon is an associate professor of communication arts at UW-Madison, where she teaches conflict communication and works with organizations experiencing conflict and communication challenges. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we also have Jessica Kahlo, who is a PhD candidate in the communication department at UW-Milwaukee, where her research is on interpersonal communication and communication technologies. Jessica, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Jessica, let's start with you. What are some of the key differences between face-to-face meetings around the boardroom table and these online video meetings?
Yeah, so we found that face-to-face groups actually make better decisions and that they make decisions about 3 times as fast as online groups.
Whoa.
Yeah, and face-to-face group conflict strategies aren't as effective online. So we do know that collaborative approaches to conflict are more effective online. But other than that, we don't know a whole lot about conflict.
Wow. So just the physical presence of someone in the room, you have better outcomes than what's happening in this video virtual realm.
Yeah, that's what the research shows.
What do you think is going on there?
I think it could be a lot of things. A lot of this research was done a while ago. I think now a lot of groups are hybrid groups, so they meet both face-to-face and online. But a lot of this research was actually conducted when that wasn't the norm, so when online groups didn't know one another. Mm-hmm. So that could be something that contributes to it.
All right. So, Sarah, what do you see that's going on with these video meetings? What are you watching for amid the pandemic?
You know, I think one of the things to distinguish between face-to-face and online communication, when we say online communication, we mean these online groups. We also mean email, like all of the forms in which we communicate electronically. But one of the things you have to pay attention to is how high context face-to-face communication is. Like you get all of the nonverbals, you can read each other's body language and tone, and that can be a lot more challenging in online settings, even in something like Zoom, where it's virtual. I think the other dynamic is, you know, it's a lot easier to tune out in a Zoom setting, in a virtual, visual setting. And so that can be really challenging. And there's just a lot happening, right? So when each of us log into our Teams meeting or Zoom meeting, you know, there may be so many other things happening in the background as well. And so workers are having to manage a lot and then also manage the technology. I don't know about you, but, you know, it takes some learning to figure out how to deal with the video and the muting and the raising of the hand. And, you know, if I'm a moderator, that's even more. And so there's just a lot of learning that happens that can just make the bandwidth of engaging in these meetings very challenging.
Yeah. I'm Sarah. Would you please share your screen? Oh, can you do that?
Yeah, no, I can't do that.
Jessica, which online meeting apps do you think work best? What are your favorites and why?
I use Zoom a lot and also Microsoft Teams. I like Zooms because you can do breakout rooms and have those smaller group interactions, which I think maybe lend themselves a little more to that interpersonal communication that gets lost in online meetings normally. Because you kind of lose those informal interactions in online meetings, like before or after meetings. So being able to like put people in smaller groups, I think might help with that.
That's really interesting you say that, because little breakout groups have just started, just come online for my kids who are doing all virtual learning. And just those smaller group settings with a teacher are really making a difference in that communication, in that interpersonal communication. What is it about small groups that might help us break through this technology issue?
I think a lot of times people start to get worried that they're going to be talking over someone in a bigger group. So then that might prevent them from speaking up in a bigger group. So putting them in a smaller group reduces that chance of interrupting or saying or trying accidentally speaking over someone, or when people start talking at exactly the same second.
Yeah. Sarah, what do you see there when you can't tell when someone else is going to talk, so you talk right over the other person? What is the etiquette there and what's going on?
You know, I think it's important to recognize that we do this in face-to-face settings as well. If we're in a staff meeting, a faculty meeting, whatever it is, there's a lot of latching that happens where we go, you know, we're kind of interrupting each other. And that's okay. And I think, in fact, in virtual settings, the more that can happen organically, sometimes the more it feels like it's an actual conversation. For me personally, I think it's important for whoever the moderator is, whoever the leader is, the organizer is, to really set the ground rules for how participants should interact and initiate. So that might be, you know, just if you have something to say, jump in to really cultivate that spirit. It may be using the hand raising function, but I think setting the ground rules from the beginning can be really helpful for participants to know how to participate and to do so in a respectful, organized way.
We're discussing video conferencing etiquette, all of the online tools and ways our workplace communication has changed amid the pandemic. We have two communication experts. Sarah McKinnon is an associate professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Jessica Kahlo is a researcher in the communication department at UW-Milwaukee. What do you want to say about the way that your team, your company is working virtually? How is communication going? When and what happens when conflict arises at work? How do you handle the miscommunication, the decision-making? Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, what are some of the challenges for online groups in navigating conflict?
Yeah, I think step one is really figuring out the mode, the platform in which conflict is best to be mediated. I don't know about you, but being in a Zoom meeting where there is tension, where there's conflict happening, can be really awkward, both for the people involved in the conflict as well as those watching. And so sometimes it's more productive to take that conflict, to take that interaction and move it to a different medium. So maybe move it to a telephone call. And I think that, you know, leaders, facilitators, or people who are organizing these sessions can really think consciously about the platform in which it's best to have a conversation about that. Personally, I think that that's a really great strategy, like moving that conversation to a different platform and maybe more of a one-on-one or smaller group dynamic, just so it can be resolved. I think the other challenge is just making sure that there's enough communication happening. So we are all sitting in our own little bubbles right now in various offices, you know, in the state and even, you know, in the nation and around the world. And so really finding ways to make sure that the communication that happens in an organic way when we're all together is still happening. And so thinking about how to use things like email, I don't know, I know a lot of organizations have been implementing Slack, which is this very interactive platform for making sure that there's an environment that's cultivated so that extra information can be communicated, really finding ways and really being conscious and intentional in implementing communication structures, I think can go a long way. And then paying attention to the gap, right? We are not together. And so all of the relational messaging that we would get normally through nonverbal communication sometimes goes away. And so finding ways to make up the difference, things like emojis and GIFs, these things can go a long way to you know, make up the difference in the low context versus high context communication that we're currently experiencing.
You mentioned a Slack, and which is certainly a big high volume use here at Wisconsin Public Radio and in our show as well. My spouse's Slack is called Sassboard. And I said, oh, is that a software product name? And he was like, no, we're just full of sass. We call it Sassboard. So you might also take a lighthearted approach to this communication.
That's right. And that's a part of, you know, I think one of the things we need to be mindful of is communicating generously and compassionately with each other, right? There is a large learning curve in figuring out how to transition what has been, you know, centuries of working together to all of a sudden working remotely. And so that takes some time to learn how to do that. And so really just being compassionate and generous with each other, I think, can go a long way. And I think for me, another tip is to, you know, whenever I'm communicating, really try to think about the listener first. So what does the listener need to hear what I'm saying? Or what might be the best way to communicate this? And think that goes down to thinking about the platform. So maybe it's email, maybe it's a phone call, and also the words I use, but really trying to package our message for the listener. And, you know, that's hard work to do, but starting with that can go a long way.
We have communication researchers to the rescue. Sarah McKinnon of UW-Madison, Jessica Kahlo of UW-Milwaukee. How often do you have virtual meetings with your coworkers? How long do they last? Do you typically have an agenda or a plan? Are they productive as the good old days in person around a table? What do you do when conflicts arise? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with communication researchers Jessica Kahlo from UW-Milwaukee and Sarah McKinnon at UW-Madison. I just read a video conferencing etiquette article. It said, video meetings are not the time to multitask. Dang. Maintain eye contact. Look directly into the webcam to initiate eye contact with your colleagues. Close other distracting apps. Cell phones away. Is there any wiggle room here? Are your Zoom calls the same as sitting around a conference table? It's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Alicia from Milwaukee about this world. Hi, Alicia. What would you like to share?
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic, my colleagues and I got sent home in March, and I work in rural Wisconsin. I happen to live in Milwaukee. I drive a long way to get to work, but one of the things I noticed was my colleagues who lived in rural Wisconsin were having a lot of connectivity issues because they don't have strong Wi-Fi. So that was one of the biggest issues and challenges we were facing, particularly at the beginning. They couldn't get connected. We used Microsoft Teams for everything. The phone calls would keep cutting out. We ended up, in many cases, using personal cell phones to call each other instead of using our meeting apps that we were supposed to be using because we just couldn't get the connectivity that we needed.
Mm. So what is your situation like today? Are you still based at home?
So many of my colleagues still are. I happen to have a toddler, so I actually do go into the office because the daycare is right next to where I work. So I happen to go back, but many of them ended up getting hotspots from our IT department. Like, we had to get additional ones so that people could have better connectivity because it just wasn't working.
Yeah. Jessica, what do you do about all the drops, all the missed information when our technology fails?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to working online. On the one hand, it's really beneficial because we can work remotely and be able to be at home while we work. But at the same time, being in rural Wisconsin, it can be really difficult to get connectivity issues. And it sounds like Alicia was dealing with those in the best ways that I would know how to do. But that's definitely a challenge that I think a lot of people also faced.
Sarah, is there a way to smooth over those rough spots when the technology is acting up, when we can't hear someone, or we're just booted out of the meeting due to a drop?
Yeah, I mean, I think a part of it is starting from scratch and asking folks what is the connectivity accessibility you have available, and then trying to figure out what is going to be the best platform based on that. Some platforms are better than others. Some platforms are better for, you know, being able to phone in and have that connection be really strong. And so if organizations can do that work at the beginning, that really helps to smooth it out so that conversations can really go well. But, you know, in the middle, I think the task is really to be generous with each other. You know, in the United States, we're really being illuminated as to the connectivity accessibility issues that we have, especially in rural areas, that questions of bandwidth are actually problems, the infrastructure, technology infrastructure. And so this is just one of the dynamics I think that we're all living with. I know I experience it with my students in classes as well. I mean, there's just connectivity issues, and that is something we have to be really generous and compassionate about.
Sarah, you were saying just, you know, to think about the communication channel for the information you're trying to send. But do you see it all in your research that the sheer volume of communication is up amid the pandemic due to the circumstances? Or are we still getting about the same amount of communication?
Yeah, I think I definitely personally have experienced an increase in the amount of communication. That may just be a perception issue because it's coming, you know, in my email, it's coming on just so many video meetings that I'm now doing. And so it feels more overwhelming. And it feels like it's also a question of how do we all begin to organize our time in a way to still allow for things like, you know, long gaps of time to actually work individually on projects and whatnot. So I think in addition to questions of technology and connectivity, this moment has also raised questions of time management. And, you know, many of us are just figuring out how to deal with that. And yeah, it's a challenge. It's a negotiation.
Sarah McKinnon, Associate Professor of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. Jessica Kahlo is here, Research Assistant in the Communication Department at UW-Milwaukee. And we're discussing workplace communication, how it's changed amid the pandemic, what to do going forward. 800-642-1234 to join in. David is joining us from UW-Whitewater, I understand. Hi, David.
Hi, guys. Hey, great show today. So I've actually done some testing around this area. This is, you know, forgive me, this is, you know, a little anecdotal, but at the beginning of the year, I wrote a book to help small businesses recover from coronavirus, which turned into a Facebook group, which turned into live interviews. And I was just broadcasting them through Facebook Live. And what happened is people said, well, I don't use Facebook. I use Twitter, or I use YouTube. And so one of the things I started to do with these live interviews of attorneys and various software folks is I started using this software called StreamYard. And StreamYard allows you to simulcast across multiple social media platforms, and you can record it as well. And so obviously live engagement is the best, right? And you can take live questions and it aggregates all the questions coming in. So the interviewer, or if you're teaching, you can answer those live and you're not forcing someone into one platform. So they're already used to those platforms and they don't have to download special software. So I think, you know, considering not forcing someone into one platform, but you know, offering the content across multiple platforms can really help get more people to engage and allow you to, you know, engage with multiple people across all those platforms.
Yeah, meeting people where they are using this StreamYard. Jessica, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great. Being able to engage people wherever platform they might be on is a great way to overcome some of those challenges with even connectivity. Like on Zoom, you can call in if you don't have the greatest Wi-Fi, I think. So that's another way to be able to make sure everyone's on the same page and be able to collaborate among more people.
Jim from Green Bay. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. My question is with the use of speakerphone. Even prior to the pandemic, in a business setting, dealing with a lot of people that placing calls on speakerphones that they just don't have good sound quality. Mm. I consider it a rude thing to do, but because of the sound quality, am I right or wrong on that? Where, you know, if you have the handset, pick it up and use it.
Jim, thank you. Sarah, what's up with speakerphone and what's the etiquette there?
Yeah, I think in an organizational setting, really making sure that whoever is leading a meeting or, you know, organizing the session is clear about what they'd like, and then that organizations make available the technology that is going to be best for communicating. So, you know, if it's a headset, making sure all employees have headsets and are able to use those, I think is great. In terms of etiquette, you know, I don't know, but I guess the question is just setting the ground rules from the beginning so that all members have a sense of how they should be communicating with each other.
Kathy emailed to ask about etiquette around being double booked for meetings. Kathy wants to know, what do you do? What is the etiquette for declining these video meetings? Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the things that's happening. You know, so many of us have calendars that are available that people can look and say, oh, they're free. Let me just schedule a meeting. And so, it happens sometimes that there's some double booking. I think, again, this is a moment where it's okay to decline. It's okay to say, you know, I have a prior commitment. I can't make it. Let's reschedule. And I also really recommend, as much as workers can do this, to decide every week, you know, what are the blocks of time that I'll be available for mm-hmm. meetings, and then to really hold hard and fast to those blocks of time. It can really become very easy that you have, you know, I don't know, 10 meetings in a day at all of these random times. And so you're not actually able to focus on work. And that's actually counterproductive. So doing the blocks of time where you're available to meet, I think it goes a long way. And it also helps to manage the cognitive dissonance and just the stuff, you know, like all of the multitasking that we're doing.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Sarah McKinnon is an associate professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Jessica Kahlo, PhD candidate at UW-Milwaukee. And you're listening to the Ideas Network.